The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations from listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely online at kopn.org. Thank you. Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I'm delighted to welcome my guest, Mr. Alexander Salmon. He's a politics writer at Slate and has written for Harper's, The New Republic, Wired, and more. He was a senior fellow at Mother Jones Magazine and has been a guest on MSNBC and Democracy Now! He was also a Livingston Award finalist for his article on crime and forestry for the New Republic. He is a graduate of Brown University. He majored in environmental studies, and he currently lives in Brooklyn, New York. Today, we are going to take a deep dive into his article on avocados for Harper's Magazine. It's titled Forbidden Fruit, the Anti-Avocado Militias of the Michoacan. Welcome, Alex.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So part of the mission of this program is to pull back the curtain on where our food comes from. And your article in Harper's made me think twice when I pick up a Mexican avocado at the grocery store. So thank you for that. I'm curious to know what drove your interest in avocados.
Yeah, I think that consumption trends in general are really fascinating, and the sort of emergence of the avocado as a, I think, really one of the outstanding food trends of the 21st century, really. It's a story that was intriguing to me for a lot of reasons. I think there's a very specific California resonance to this trend as well. And I grew up in California. So for me, there's just something of a hometown salience too. So that sort of piqued my interest. I think generally I've done some reporting on supply chains and resources and stuff like that. And, you know, once I started scratching into this a little bit, it's sort of all those factors became apparent to me. And it seemed like an interesting story.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I've learned over my years in doing this program and researching more about food nutrition and the environment is that there is a huge violent underbelly in so many of the foods that we consume. Sugar, for example, is one, but I had no idea how much violence was involved in the avocado industry. And as you say, you know, when I think of avocados, I think of California production. I had no idea that 80% of the avocados we eat today come from Mexico.
Right. Yeah. And they come from this very, very small region, actually, in Mexico. There's the one state of Michoacán was for decades the only place that was allowed to export avocados to the United States. And even within Michoacán, really, it's a much smaller area than that. It's actually really a 100-mile stretch of fertile soil that produces an overwhelming percentage of the American avocados and or the avocados consumed in the U.S. and really a large percentage of the world's avocados.
Yeah. And I love that you've got this environmental studies background, because, of course, I always think about monocultures and how that affects biodiversity and planetary resilience. And so I see that as being a problem whenever we start, especially in Mexico, taking out native pine forests in preference for this monoculture crop. What did you see there?
Yeah, it's a very dynamic landscape. It tells you so much of this story just by what's growing out of the ground. And so this region in Michoacán, it's a volcanic highland. So it's cool. It's very wet. There's a lot of rain. And historically, it's been covered in these native pine forests. That's what that region is known for. And that's endemic to that climate. It makes a lot of sense. When you have that much rain, the hydrological cycle is reliant in a lot of ways on these pine forests to ensure that that water makes it into the water table, becomes groundwater. And, you know, there's all these complex dynamics that aren't to any landscape really is the case. In Michoacán, we've seen this incredibly widespread and total overhaul of the landscape, and that those pine forests are being very, very quickly cut down, torn out, and replaced by avocado orchards, avocado trees. And they behave very, very differently, right? The way that they interact with the landscape, with the hydrological cycle, is profoundly different. And so in a very short period of time, that change in the trees has manifested in a radical change in the biosphere, in the water cycle, and in the landscape, obviously, as well.
I think it was you that reported on how in indigenous cultures, there's a belief that trees help seed clouds to bring more rain. And there's actually research to support this. And so I'm thinking about how the destruction of the native pine trees have led to increasing shortages of water. Tell me the water story of that region.
Yeah, the water story, I think, is really the most acute rendering of what has happened there. And again, it's happened in just a handful of years. It's very, very rapid, these changes. But yeah, this went quickly from being a region, as I think I already said, an immense amount of rainfall every year. And in a very short period of time, because of those changes, the demand, the avocado orchards, avocado trees are incredibly water intensive. I mean, it's very, very demanding. And because of all these different elements, I mean, the fact, of course, that we have research now that shows that pine trees produce these aerosols, which help draw rain out of clouds. When you get rid of all that stuff and turn it into avocado orchards, well, they draw an incredible amount of water out of the ground, and they don't obviously help draw it out of the sky. And so, in a handful of years, we've seen this region, which has some of the most incredible water richness of anywhere in Mexico, turn into a region where water is scarce. And it's happened in ways where, in a handful of years, they've seen widespread sinkholes, which was once very uncommon in that region. You see the sinkholes everywhere. There have been tremors, which they think is because of the groundwater has been so impacted, so quickly drained, that all of a sudden we're seeing movements that are showing up as near earthquake seismic activity. And then, of course, the lack of rainfall has been very astounding. So the lakes in the region, there are multiple lakes that are huge freshwater lakes, are drying up incredibly quickly. This stuff is exacerbated by climate change, but all at once, at every level, this region with this very, very rich hydrological resource has basically been drained off in a number of years and has entered into crisis mode.
And then there's also the use of pesticides. And I have to say, just for the record, that I only buy organic avocados. And that's because not only for the residue that's on it for the end eater, but because of the stories that you describe here and elsewhere that I found in doing my research on this topic, where water is now becoming polluted from the pesticide runoff. Do you know offhand what percentage of the avocados grown in this region are organic versus what we call conventional or where pesticides are used?
I don't have the exact numbers. I would pretty confidently say that the majority of these avocados are conventionally grown. And, you know, in talking to people in the region, the prevalence of pesticides is very obvious. I mean, speaking to a handful of different people and right to cite these reports, one of the largest lakes in the region is critically polluted by pesticides and chemicals and fertilizers. But also, I was hearing that if you drive through this region, you can taste it, you can feel it. The prevalence of these agrochemical products is very substantial, to the point that you can feel it wafting through the region when you're there. So it's definitely significant.
That's so sad. Well, let me go back to your particular visit to this region. How did you arrange that?
Yeah. So the town that I was most interested in is this town called Chiron, which is a small indigenous community. It's sort of right in the middle of the avocado belt, right in the heart of that 100-mile stretch. And they, a handful of years ago in Chiron, had this sort of radical environmental uprising. And it was really actually directed as both an anti-crime, sort of anti-corruption, anti-cartel initiative, but also an attempt to crack down on illegal logging, which was something that afflicted the area. And out of this, they stood up this municipal project, this sort of new charter, which really put environmental concerns at the forefront of the town. And in so doing, they illegalized avocados. And they did it for a number of reasons. Obviously, it was to protect the pine forest from the encroaching avocado orchards. Really, it was to protect their water source, which the whole town obviously relied upon, and the threat of avocado orchards to the freshwater and the natural resources there was very obvious to them. And given the sort of growth in avocado consumption, its explosion as a trend food, I really wanted to go down there and see what they had done, why they had done that. And the sound of like a town outlawing the avocado as part of some radical experiment, it sounds kind of zany, but of course it actually there's a lot to it. And so it's a difficult process. This is an area that is, I should also say, highly militarized because both of the prevalence of violence in the avocado trade, which is something, you know, you've alluded to, is very meaningful. And also because this is one little island in the middle of this industry. And so to get there, it was you drive for hours into this very remote region, And then when you finally get there, there are these militarized checkpoints. There are militias, carrying significant weaponry, and you have to get permission to come in. And so the negotiation to get in there was not easy, and it took quite a while. And even having lined it all up in the weeks prior to my trip there, there was some question as to whether or not I was even going to be allowed to enter the confines of the town there. And we had some negotiating to do at the border, but eventually ended up getting in there and were able to see the full sweep of their project there, and both, what they've been able to accomplish as part of this environmental policy, and also the ever encroaching threat of the industry.
So, in terms of making arrangements to go to this region, which I can only imagine must have been extremely unnerving, did you have to arrange something through the Mexican government?
Yes, actually, through the local council there. So technically, Chiron has seceded from the state of Mexico, and there's this provision in the Mexican Constitution which says that for indigenous communities, if they can prove a history of cultural continuity, they can petition to secede from the state and self-govern. And Chiron, in this incredible way, the town, when it was undergoing this radical reimagining of what they refer to as the uprising, this uprising that they had against environmental depredation, they put together this charter and then they petitioned the state to become independent. And the Mexican Supreme Court upheld their claim in 2014. It found that that was a legitimate claim. So technically, it's an independent state. It's a breakaway state, which is incredible. And so I had to clear it with their council, which is highly influenced by this indigenous culture. The Purépecha is the group that's there, and they have their own indigenous language and customs. And so I submitted basically an appeal to the council there. They have a 12-person democratically elected council that governs the region, and they approved it. I told them why I wanted to go there and asked if they would be willing to show me some of the stuff, and I told them what my project was, and they approved it. But of course, nothing was is without complications. So even with that clearance, when I finally got there, they were, I would say, to put it mildly, I would say they were suspicious of my presence and what I was actually after. So, but we managed to get in, and then they were very willing to show me around and give me a full lay of the land of what's going on out there, and it was very, very eye-opening.
I really appreciated that part of your story that explained how these indigenous cultures are allowed to break away and set up their own states. That was a beautiful aspect, I think, of this story.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's both, it's one of these, I think when we talk about environmental issues and climate change and some of these huge crises, it's always hard to conceive of like what a solution might look like. And in this case, this is a very, very interesting mode of putting both political power to work in service of environmental concerns, but also, there's this really rich history. And, it goes all the way back to really the colonial period of Spanish conquest in Mexico. And I think the fact that you can trace this story in a lot of ways back that far, to me, yeah, I think it's a very, it was a sort of very compelling subplot in this. It certainly was a big reason why I wanted to write about it at length.
Yeah, I think the history of our food, as well as the environmental impacts, are just so compelling. Let me take one break because we're about halfway through. And I just want to remind our listeners that if you're just joining us, you're tuned into Food Sleuth Radio. And today we're speaking with Mr. Alexander Salmon. He's a politics writer at Slate. He's written for Harper's, The New Republic, Wired, and more. We are diving into a recent article that he wrote for Harper's. It's titled Forbidden Fruit, The Anti-Avocado Militias of Michoacan. Okay, Alex, it's my understanding in doing my research prior to this interview that this uprising against the planting of avocados and really the stopping of the logging was a women's led movement. Was that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It was really interesting, sort of very organic uprising against this logging outfit, against really against municipal corruption, which was there was both these loggers, and they were tied in with the mayor at the time, and so there was all this municipal corruption, and yeah, the women of the town led this uprising. It sort of was told to me as a very spur of the moment public demonstration in a lot of ways. And that actually, that feminist valence is really evident in the town still. So when they wrote this charter for the new government, they put in a provision that said that of the 12 council members who will govern the area, at least a third of them have to be women. There are minimum thresholds for female participation in government. And so, yeah, that legacy of that female-led uprising is really still very apparent in the state as it exists today, which is also an interesting detail, I think.
Yeah, I do too. All right. So you are in this region. You are really traveling with people who are wearing highly sophisticated arms. And it was interesting when I looked at the statistics that 80% of the Avocados that we eat here in the States are coming from Mexico, and 80% of the weapons that are used in this region come from the United States. Tell me what you think about that.
Right, that's an amazing comparison because that is exactly the sort of nature of modern trade, right? The modern trade regime, the NAFTA regime in North America, you can't talk about it without talking about the traffic, the selling of weapons, whether it's illegal or legal. There's been a massive influx of arms into Mexico from the United States, and that's an undeniable aspect of the free trade corridor. And on the other side, what have we got in exchange? Well, we've managed to do a lot of extractive, to install a lot of extractive industries in places like Mexico and benefit from them. So what we're getting back in turn is obviously these avocados, which are really in some way, really like a water policy. I mean, these avocados are incredibly water intensive. It takes 12 times as much water to grow an avocado as it does a tomato. I think it's right on par with the amount of water it takes to grow a pound of almonds. A pound of avocados is right at that same level. So, in a country where, especially in California, especially in the American West, water is at a premium, we've managed to set up this system where we're basically extracting the water from Mexico and shipping it back up north. And so, yeah, I think that comparison that you make is incredibly apt because none of that would happen without the presence of violence. And violence plays a really important role in this stuff. And so, I think the environmentalism that was on display in Chiron, it's not a kumbaya sort of environmentalism, right? It's not a bunch of tree huggers and hippies the way we might think of it. It's one of the first things they did was charter a militia group, and they outfitted them heavily with AR-15s, with pistols, with serious firepower to say the threats to this landscape are going to need to be defended with weapons. And weapons are a part of the avocado industry as well, and that's why they need them. So I traveled around with this militia group. I went on the rounds with them, and it was not tense. It was not a situation where it wasn't like private security sitting around twiddling their thumbs. It was everyone is armed at all times and prepared for what is a near military conflict at a moment's notice.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you brought up the water issue because I was looking at an article that Tom Philpott had written way back in 2014 in Mother Jones, and he brought in some data on water needs. And when you think of an avocado, you don't really think about the high water demands. Like, you don't think of it as a juicy fruit, like you would say an orange. Nor, of course, would you think of almonds as being high water demand, but there's a great chart. And what really stood out to me in that was that it was the irrigated water demands that were so different between California and Mexico. So in California, according to this article in Mother Jones, 74.1 gallons of irrigated water was needed to grow a pound of avocados. In Mexico, probably because of their rich water resources, only 31.9 gallons of irrigated water was needed for 1 pound. So it makes sense from a water perspective that you would want to grow this particular crop in places where you didn't have to irrigate so much. But that's shifting now with climate change. And I wonder how Mexico is going to navigate that.
Yeah, it's really interesting too, because I think that's a very live statistic. Like, I think that when the industry was first setting up down there, initially they said, we don't actually need to irrigate it at all. There's such abundance in water here that we can just let it rain and, we don't need to drive any gallons of water to these trees. And then obviously that changed very quickly because once you start getting rid of the pine trees, the hydrological system changes. There's less water. So you start having to direct it, you start having to tap groundwater. And so that number, 39 gallons, now, I would not be surprised if it's a much higher number than that. When I was down there talking to avocado farmers who were sort of like small-time producers, they were tapping reservoirs. There was a huge concern, and they were draining these sort of small stockpiles of water that they'd been able to set aside, were all getting tapped. And so I have no reason to doubt that number that when Tom wrote that piece, and I would be really surprised it wasn't much higher now, just because they're so demanding. And we see evidence actually of this in the few other places in the Western Hemisphere where we've seen avocados grown at scale. In Chile, there was a big avocado industry for a time, but it ended up being so water intensive that the region there became so arid that there were massive wildfires and the whole region burned. And it doesn't look like the avocado industry is going to recover there. So wildfire also becomes a part of this story at some point as well. But it's pretty astounding how quickly that can change because the demand on the water system is just so immense.
Yeah, and with so much focus on the income that this crop is bringing in today, I wonder how much futuristic thinking is going on.
Right, sure. And it's hard to, right. How can you value these things in a long-term way and put them up against the short-term profits? It's a really tough question, especially in an area like Michoacán, where this is not one of the rich states in Mexico. This is not a place with a history of high employment, of high wages. It's a place with a history of a lot of drug dealing. It's a place where there's been a lot of cartel presence. There famously was a place where a lot of the methamphetamine trade was being based out of Mexico. And then a handful of small crops that aren't cash crops that don't make a lot of money. And so when faced with what are you going to do in this region to make money? Well, there's one way that you can hit it rich pretty quickly, and that's to grow avocados. So the sort of economic reality of this situation is it's nothing to turn up your nose at. It's a very serious calculation, I think, for a lot of people in an area where there's a lot of poverty.
Right. Let's talk about NAFTA because this is a really key point, I think, in how this North American Free Trade Agreement has affected everything, right? It's affected the ability of Mexicans to live in subsistence on their land. It's affected immigration. I thought it was interesting how there were parts of Michoacán where people were uprooted from their homes. Because these thugs came in and wanted to take over the homes and the land to produce more avocados. So, how has this agricultural product impacted the immigration that we see here in the United States? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the interesting things is that, right, the NAFTA obviously has a profound impact on the food supply of both the United States and Mexico. And when it was enacted, in particular, small farmers, subsistence farmers of things like corn really suffered in Mexico. I mean, we're talking about, I think the estimates are in the millions of Mexican farmers basically lost their land or lost their ability to sustain themselves because the corn that was being imported into Mexico, coming from the United States as part of this agreement, was massively subsidized by the US agricultural system, and they couldn't compete with that. And the impact to immigration there is, yeah, again, it's profound because if you have millions of farmers, small farmers going off their land, losing the ability to support themselves, well, what do? There are only a handful of things you can do. And so Michoacán in particular, where I think this trend was very much on display, is known really for also for exporting people because there are a ton of immigrants in the United States who've come from that region because there isn't a lot of opportunity and the avocado industry sort of follows on the back of that. And that's certainly a very substantial part of the story as well.
Well, I'm really glad you're discussing this because I think that there's so much rhetoric here in the United States. There's so much hatred directed towards immigrants. I think we have to ask why would people want to leave their home country and their families and come to the United States? What is going on economically? And I think we should be taking a deep dive into the impact of NAFTA.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, these things have a long tail and NAFTA's been with us for a long time now, but it's not like that those economic realities have ceased to play a role in the everyday lives of people there. So I think it's very much with us.
Yeah. Now, tell me how NAFTA has affected the avocado trade, because it's my understanding that originally there was a limit on the imports of avocados to the United States in an effort to protect California farmers. But the California avocado farmers are sort of going belly up because of the lack of water. Talk to me about these relationships.
Yeah, it's an interesting story because I think now if you read trade publications, there's this celebration of the avocado as like this cipher of the promise of free trade, that it's like really one of the great success stories. And the real truth is much more complicated than that. When NAFTA was initially passed, actually avocados were exempted from the free trade corridor because of those protections that you mentioned. The California farmers, obviously, some of them didn't want there to be Mexican avocados coming up and being sold cheaply. And so that was actually one of the few things that was not part of NAFTA. And it took actually a handful of years. It took until the late 90s for avocados to become included in the free trade corridor. And they only did so on a very provisional basis. It was a very slow rollout over a handful of years. Only a couple of states were allowed to import from Mexico. And of course, only from this one state, the only from the state of Michoacán, nowhere else. And that really only happened because just skyrocketing water prices in California because of these successive years of drought really made it impossible for California farmers to produce a meaningful crop at all. So a lot of them at this point had had investments in Mexico anyways. And so there's a sort of cynical calculation going on here where by the late 90s, There are no real small farmers of avocados in California anymore. Most of them are big agricultural conglomerates, and they had already invested in Mexico. They had already sort of primed themselves to benefit from this trade when it was established. And so, with those drought conditions in the late 90s, it sort of opened up the door for this and slowly became the norm. And then over a handful of years, it becomes a crop that is just basically almost entirely grown in Mexico and nowhere else.
I can't help but think that after taking such a deep dive into this topic, that that's impacted how you eat, or at least how you think about the food when it reaches your mouth. What happened to you after writing this story?
Yeah, it certainly does make an impact. It's hard to, I think that I obviously don't want to be preachy. I don't want to say, I don't want to preach to any of your listeners here or to anyone else. I think, my thinking about this has always been that it's valuable to know where things are coming from in this very global world that we live in. I think these things are often obscured from us, and I think it's good to see what goes into the food that we eat, the things that we consume. These supply chains are all, I think they're fascinating, and sometimes they're fascinating in horrifying ways and sometimes in less horrifying ways. But yeah, it certainly has given me pause, I think, in my own sort of eating habits. I think about it more. And I also, when I'm out in the world, just seeing how prevalent avocados have become, avocado oil, and all, it's like the broad scale takeover of this food product, I think, is fascinating to me. And I think I like to think about food, obviously, as a sort of personal preference, a sort of innate personal expression. But a lot of times it's the result of these massive economic forces, these huge advertising firms, these trade agreements, these really big macroeconomic motivators that are the reason that you can get avocado on your Subway sandwich now, or as a staple at Chipotle, the largest fast food chains in the world now all have these things. So yeah, I think it changed my outlook, but I certainly don't want to sit here and say you shouldn't be eating this, that there's blood on your hands or whatever if you do. But I do think that to see it as it is, I think, is valuable in and of itself.
Right. Well, I did research how many advertising dollars went into avocados because people were like, how can the avocado industry afford to have an ad at the Super Bowl? But about $100 million were spent on advertising. And I know in my own dietitian circles, we are very pro avocado because they're high in fiber, they're high in that healthy fat, they're a nutritious food. But I think what your article does, or at least did for me, was help me understand how precious this commodity is. And how we need to be thinking about the people whose hands helped harvest that and work towards more compassion in our food system.
Yeah, definitely. Right. It's one of these things where I don't think it's bad to eat an avocado. I think that they're great, but is it something that we should be having for every meal? Maybe not. Maybe it's something a little more precious than it's sort of presented as now, given its ubiquity. So I think that's a
Yeah.
really good way of thinking about it.
All right, well, we've got to close, but I want to remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn for KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. But most of all, I want to thank my guest, Mr. Alexander Salmon, politics writer at Slate. We've been talking about an excellent article he wrote for Harper's titled Forbidden Fruit, the Anti-Avocado Militias of Michoacan. And I will provide a link to that website. And thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. That was a blast.